6. Chivalry's Shadow. There are two traditions about the custom of giving royal offspring names suggestive of virtues or abilities. The one that is most commonly held is that somehow these names are binding, that when such a name is attached to a child who will be trained in the skill, somehow the skill melds the name to the child, and the child cannot help but grow up to practice the virtue ascribed to him or her by name. This first tradition is most doggedly believed by those same ones most prone to doff their caps in the presence of minor nobility. A more ancient tradition attributes such names to accident, at least initially. It is said that King Taker and King Ruler, the first two of the Out-Islanders to rule what would become the six duchies, had no such names at all. Rather, that their names in their own foreign tongue were very similar to the sounds of such words in the duchy's tongue, and thus came to be known by their homonyms rather than by their true names. But for the purposes of royalty, it is better to have the common folk believe that a boy given a noble name must grow to have a noble nature.
Boy!
I lifted my head. Of the half dozen or so other lads lounging about the fire, no one else even flinched. The girls took even less notice as I moved up to take my place at the opposite side of the low table where Master Fedrin knelt. He had mastered some trick of inflection that let all know when boy meant boy, and when it meant the bastard. I tucked my knees under the low table and sat on my feet, then presented Fedrin with my sheet of pith paper. As he ran his eyes down my careful columns of letters, I let my attention wander. Winter had harvested us and stored us here in the great hall. Outside, a sea storm lashed the walls of the keep, while breakers pounded the cliffs with a force that occasionally sent a tremor through the stone floor beneath us. The heavy overcast had stolen even the few hours of watery daylight that winter had left us. It seemed to me that a darkness lay over us like a fog, both outside and within. The dimness penetrated my eyes so that I felt sleepy without feeling tired. For a brief moment, I let my senses expand and felt the winter sluggishness of the hounds, where they dozed and twitched in the corners. Not even there could I find a thought or image to interest me. Fires burned in all three of the big hearths, and different groups had gathered before each. At one, fletchers busied themselves with their work, lest tomorrow be a clear enough day to allow for a hunt. I longed to be there, for Sherf's mellow voice was rising and falling in the telling of some tale, broken frequently with appreciative laughter from her listeners. At the end half, children's voices piped along in the chorus of a song. I recognized it as the shepherd's song, a counting tune. A few watchful mothers tapped toes as they tatted at their lace-making, while Jerdan's withered old fingers on the harp strings kept the young voices almost in tune. Here, at our hearth, children old enough to sit still and learn letters did so. Fedrin saw to that. His sharp blue eyes missed nothing.
"Here,"
he said to me, pointing.
"You've forgotten to cross their tails. Remember how I showed you? Justice, open your eyes and get back to your penwork. Doze off again and I'll let you bring us another log for the fire. Charity, you can help him if you smirk again. Other than that," and his attention was suddenly back on my work again, "your lettering is much improved, not only on these Dutchian characters, but on the Out-Islander runes as well. Though those can't really be properly brushed onto such poor paper. The surface is too porous and takes the ink too well. Good pounded bark sheets are what you want for runes." And he ran a finger appreciatively over the sheet he was working on. "Continue to show this type of work, and before winter's out, I'll let you make me a copy of Queen Bidewell's remedies. What do you say to that?" I tried to smile and be properly flattered. Copywork was not usually given to students. Good paper was too rare.
and one careless brushstroke could ruin a sheet. I knew the remedies was a fairly simple set of herbal properties and prophecies, but any copying was an honor to aspire to. Fedrin gave me a fresh sheet of pith paper. As I rose to return to my place, he lifted a hand to stop me. "Boy!" I paused. Fedrin looked uncomfortable. "I don't know who to ask of this except you. Properly, I'd ask your parents, but..." Mercifully, he let the sentence die. He scratched his beard meditatively with his ink-stained fingers. "Winter's soon over, and I'll be on my way again. Do you know what I do in summer, boy? I wander all the 6 duchies getting herbs and berries and roots for my inks, and making provisions for the papers I need. It's a good life, walking free on the roads in summers and guesting at the keep here all winter. There's much to be said for scribing for a living." He looked at me meditatively. I looked back, wondering what he was getting at. "I take an apprentice every few years. Some of them work out and go on to do scribing for the lesser keeps. Some don't. Some don't have the patience for the detail or the memory for the inks. I think you would. What would you think about becoming a scribe?" The question caught me completely off guard, and I stared at him mutely. It wasn't just the idea of becoming a scribe. It was the whole notion that Fedrin would want me to be his apprentice, to follow him about and learn the secrets of his trade. Several years had passed since I had begun my bargain with the old king. Other than the nights I spent in Chade's company, or my stolen afternoons with Molly and Carrie, I had never thought of anyone finding me companionable, let alone good material for an apprentice. Fedrin's proposal left me speechless. He must have sensed my confusion, for he smiled his genial, young-old smile. "Well, think on it, boy. Scribing's a good trade. And what other prospects do you have, between the two of us? I think that some time away from Buckkeep might do you good." "Away from Buckkeep?" I repeated in wonder. It was like someone opening a curtain. I had never considered the idea. Suddenly the roads leading away from Buckkeep gleamed in my mind, and the weary maps I had been forced to study became places I could go. It transfixed me. "Yes," Fedrin said softly, "leave Buckkeep. As you grow older, chivalry's shadow will grow thinner. It will not always shelter you. Better you were your own man with your own life and calling to content you before his protection is entirely gone, but you don't have to answer me now. Think about it. Discuss it with Burridge, perhaps." And he handed me my pith paper and sent me back to my place. I thought about his words, but it was not Burridge I took them to. In the feeble hours of a new day, Chade and I were crouched head to head, I picking up the red shards of a broken crock that Slink had overset, while Chade salvaged the fine black seeds that had scattered in all directions. Slink clung to the top of a sagging tapestry and chirred apologetically, but I sensed his amusement. "Come all the way from Calabar, these seeds, you skinny little pelt!" Chade scolded him. "Calabar," I said, and dredged out, "a day's travel past our border with Sand's Edge."
"That's right, my boy,"
Chade muttered approvingly. "Have you ever been there?"
"Me? No, no. I meant that they came from that far. I had to send to Faircrest for them. They've a large market there, one that draws trade from all 6 duchies, and many of our neighbours as well."
"Oh, Faircrest. Have you ever been there?" Chade considered.
"A time or two, when I was a younger man. I remember the noise mostly, and the heat. Inland places are like that, too dry, too hot. I was glad to return to Buckkeep."
"Was there any other place you ever went that you liked better than Buckkeep?" Chade straightened slowly, his pale hand cupped full of fine black seed.
"Why don't you just ask me your question instead of beating around the bush?"
So I told him of Fedrin's offer, and also of my sudden realization that maps were more than lines and colors. They were places and possibilities, and I could leave here and be someone else, be a scribe or...
"No."
Chade spoke softly, but abruptly.
"No matter where you went, you would still be chivalry's bastard. Fedrin is more perspicacious than I believed him to be, but he still doesn't understand. Not the whole picture. He sees that here at court you must always be a bastard, must always be something of a pariah. What he doesn't realize is that here, partaking of King Shrewd's bounty, learning your lessons under his eye, you are not a threat to him. Certainly you are under chivalry's shadow here. Certainly it does protect you. But were you away from here, far from being unneedful of such protection, you would become a danger to King Shrewd, and a greater danger to his heirs after him. You would have no simple life of freedom as a wandering scribe. Rather, you would be found in your inn bed with your throat cut some morning, or with an arrow through you on the high road. A coldness shivered through me.
But why? I asked softly. Chade sighed. He dumped the seeds into a dish, dusted his hands lightly to shake loose those that clung to his fingers.
"Because you're a royal bastard, and hostage to your own bloodline. For now, as I say, you're no threat to Shrewd. You're too young, and besides, he has you right where he can watch you. But he's looking down the road, and you should be too. These are restless times. The Out-Islanders are getting braver about their raids. The coast folk are beginning to grumble, saying we need more patrol ships, and some say warships of our own, to raid as we are raided. But the inland duchies want no part of paying for ships of any kind, but especially not warships that might precipitate us into a full-scale war. They complain the coast is all the king thinks of, with no care for their farming, and the mountain folk are becoming more chary about the use of their passes. The trade fees grow steeper every month, so the merchants mumble and complain to each other. To the south, in Sand's Edge and beyond, there is drought, and times are hard. Everyone there curses, as if the king and Verity were to blame for that as well. Verity is a fine fellow to have a mug with, but he is neither the soldier nor the diplomat that chivalry was. He would rather hunt winter buck, or listen to a minstrel by the fireside than travel winter roads in raw weather, just to stay in touch with the other duchies. Sooner or later, if things do not improve, people will look about and say, well, a bastard's not so large a thing to make a fuss over. Chivalry should have come to power. He'd soon put a stop to all this. He might have been a bit stiff about protocol, but at least he got things done, and he didn't let foreigners trample all over us.
So chivalry might yet become king? The question sent a queer thrill to me. Instantly I was imagining his triumphant return to Buck Keep, our eventual meeting, and... What then? Chade seemed to be reading my face.
No, boy. Not likely at all. Even if the folk all wanted him to, I doubt that he'd go against what he set upon himself or against the king's wishes. But it would cause mumblings and grumblings, and those could lead to riots and skirmishes, oh, and a generally bad climate for a bastard to be running around free in. You'd have to be settled one way or another, either as a corpse or as the king's tool.
The king's tool?
I see.
An oppression settled over me. My brief glimpse of blue skies arching over yellow roads and me traveling down them astride sooty suddenly vanished. I thought of the hounds in their kennels instead, or of the hawk, hooded and strapped, that rode on the king's wrist and was loosed only to do the king's will.
It doesn't have to be that bad.
Chade said quietly. Most prisons are of our own making. A man makes his own freedom, too. I'm never going to get to go anywhere, am I? Despite the newness of the idea, traveling suddenly seemed immensely important to me.
I wouldn't say that.
Chade was rummaging about for something to use as a stopper on the dish full of seeds. He finally contented himself with putting a saucer atop it.
You'll get to go many places, quietly, and when the family interests require you to go there, but that's not all that different for any prince of the blood. Do you think chivalry got to choose where he would go to work his diplomacy? Do you think Verity likes being sent off to view towns raided by out-islanders? To hear the complaints of folks who insist that if only they'd been better fortified or better manned, none of this would have happened? A true prince has very little freedom when it comes to where he will go or how he will spend his time. Chivalry has probably more of both now than he ever had before. Except that he can't come back to Buckkeep.
The flash of insight made me freeze, my hands full of shards.
Except that he can't come back to Buckkeep.
It doesn't do to stir folks up with visits from a former king-in-waiting. Better he faded quietly away. I tossed the shards into the earth.
At least he gets to go somewhere,
I muttered. I can't even go to town.
And it's that important to you? To go down to a grubby, greasy little port like Buckkeep Town?
There are other people there. I hesitated. Not even Chade knew of my town friends. I plunged ahead. They call me New Boy, and they don't think the bastard every time they look at me. I had never put it into words before, but suddenly the attraction of town was quite clear to me.
Ah,
said Chade, and his shoulders moved as if he sighed. But he was silent, and a moment later, he was telling me how one could sicken a man just by feeding him rhubarb and spinach at the same sitting, sicken him even to death if the portions were sufficient, and never set a bit of poison on the table at all. I asked him how to keep others at the same table from also being sickened, and our discussion wandered from there. Only later did it seem to me that his words regarding chivalry had been almost prophetic.
It was 2 days later when I was surprised to be told that Fedrin had requested my services for a day or so. I was surprised even more when he gave me a list of supplies he required from town, and enough silver to buy them, with 2 extra coppers for myself. I held my breath, expecting that Burrich or one of my other masters would forbid it, but instead, I was told to hurry on my way. I went out of the gates with a basket on my arm and my brain giddy with sudden freedom. I counted up the months since I had last been able to slip away from Buckkeep, and was shocked to find it had been a year or better. I immediately planned to renew my old familiarity with the town. No one had told me when I had to return, and I was confident I could snatch an hour or two to myself, and no one the wiser. The variety of the items on Fedrin's list took me all over the town. I had no idea what use a scribe had for dried sea maid's hair or for a peck of forester's nuts. Perhaps he used them to make his colored inks, I decided, and when I could not find them in the regular shops, I took myself down to the harbor bazaar, where anyone with a blanket and something to sell could declare himself a merchant. The seaweed I found swiftly enough there, and learned it was a common ingredient in chowder. The nuts took longer, for those were something that would have come from inland rather than from the sea, and there were fewer traders who dealt in such things. But find them I did, alongside baskets of porcupine quills and carved wooden beads and nut cones and pounded bark fabric. The woman who presided over the blanket was old, and her hair had gone quite silver rather than white or grey. She had a strong, straight nose, and her eyes were on bony shelves over her cheeks. It was a racial heritage both strange and oddly familiar to me, and a shiver walked down my back when I suddenly knew she was from the mountains.
kept it," said the woman at the next mat as I completed my purchase. I glanced at her, thinking she was addressing the woman I had just paid. But she was staring at me. "Kept it," she said quite insistently, and I wondered what it meant in her language. It seemed a request for something, but the older woman only stared coldly out into the street. So I shrugged at her younger neighbor apologetically and turned away as I stowed the nuts in my basket. I hadn't got more than a dozen steps away when I heard her shriek, "Kep it!" yet again. I looked back to see the two women engaged in a struggle. The older one gripped the younger one's wrists, and the younger one struggled and thrashed and kicked to get free of her. Around her, other merchants were standing to their feet in alarm and snatching their own merchandise out of harm's way. I might have turned back to watch, had not another more familiar face met my eyes.
"Nosebleed!"
I exclaimed. She turned to face me full, and for an instant I thought I had been mistaken. A year had passed since I'd last seen her. How could a person change so much? The dark hair that used to be in sensible braids behind her ears now fell free past her shoulders, and she was dressed not in a jerkin and loose trousers, but in blouse and skirt. The adult garments put me at a loss for words. I might have turned aside and pretended I addressed someone else, had her dark eyes not challenged me as she asked me coldly.
"Nosebleed?"
I stood my ground. "Aren't you Molly Nosebleed?" She lifted a hand to brush some hair back from her cheek.
"I'm Molly Chandler."
I saw recognition in her eyes, but her voice was chill as she added,
"I'm not sure that I know you. Your name, sir?"
Confused, I reacted without thinking. I quested toward her, found her nervousness, and was surprised by her fears. Thought and voice, I sought to soothe it.
"I'm new boy,"
I said, without hesitation. Her eyes widened with surprise, and then she laughed at what she construed as a joke. The barrier she had erected between us burst like a soap bubble, and suddenly I knew her as I had before. There was the same warm kinship between us that reminded me of nothing so much as Nosy. All awkwardness disappeared. A crowd was forming about the struggling women, but we left it behind as we strolled up the cobbled street. I admired her skirts, and she calmly informed me that she had been wearing skirts for several months now, and that she quite preferred them to trousers. This one had been her mother's. She was told that one simply couldn't get wool woven this fine any more, or a red as bright as it was dyed. She admired my clothes, and I suddenly realized that perhaps I appeared to her as different as she to me. I had my best shirt on, my trousers had been washed only a few days ago, and I wore boots as fine as any man-at-arms, despite Burridge's objections about how rapidly I outgrew them. She asked my business, and I told her. I was on errands for the writing master at the keep. I told her, too, that he was in need of 2 beeswax tapers, a total fabrication on my part, but one that allowed me to remain by her side as we strolled up the winding street. Our elbows bumped companionably, and she talked. She was carrying a basket of her own on her arm. It had several packets and bundles of herbs in it, for scenting candles, she told me. Beeswax took the scent much better than tallow, in her opinion. She made the best scented candles in Buckkeep. Even the other 2 Chandlers in town admitted it. "This, smell this. This was lavender, wasn't it lovely?" Her mother's favorite, and hers too. "This was crush sweet. And this, bee balm." This was thresher's root. Not her favorite, no, but some said it made a good candle to cure headaches and winter glooms. Mavis Threadsnip had told her that Molly's mother had mixed it with other herbs and made a wonderful candle, one that would calm even a colicky baby. So Molly had decided to try, by experimenting, to see if she could find the right herbs and recreate her mother's recipe. Her calm flaunting of her knowledge and skills left me burning to distinguish myself in her eyes. "I know the thresher's root,"
I told her. Some use it to make an ointment for sore shoulders and backs. That's where the name comes from. But if you distill a tincture from it and mix it well in wine, it's never tasted, and it will make a grown man sleep a day and a night and a day again, or make a child die in his sleep. Her eyes widened as I spoke, and at my last words a look of horror came over her face. I fell silent and felt the sharp awkwardness again.
"How do you know such things?"
she demanded breathlessly.
I heard an old travelling midwife talking to our midwife up at the keep,"
I improvised.
"It was a sad story she told, of an injured man given some to help him rest, but his baby got into it as well. A very, very sad story."
Her face was softening, and I felt her warming toward me.
"I only tell it to be sure you are careful of the root. Don't leave it out where any child can get at it." "Thank you, I shan't. Are you interested in herbs and roots? I didn't know a scribe cared about such things."
I suddenly realized that she thought I was the scribe's help boy. I didn't see any reason to tell her otherwise.
"Oh, Fedrin uses many things for his dyes and inks. Some copies he makes quite plain, but others are fancy, all done with birds and cats and turtles and fish. He showed me an herbal with the greens and flowers of each herb, done as the border for the page."
"That I should dearly love to see," she said in a heartfelt way, and I instantly began thinking of ways to purloin it for a few days.
I might be able to get you a copy to read, not to keep, but to study, for a few days,"
I offered hesitantly.
She laughed, but there was a slight edge in it, as if I could read. "Oh, but I imagine you've picked up some letters, running about for the scribe's errands."
"A few," I told her, and was surprised at the envy in her eyes when I showed her my list and confessed I could read all 7 words on it. A sudden shyness came over her. She walked more slowly, and I realized we were getting close to the chandlery. I wondered if her father still beat her, but dared not ask about it. Her face, at least, showed no sign of it. We reached the chandlery door and paused there. She made some sudden decision, for she put her hand on my sleeve, took a breath, and then asked,
"Do you think you could read something for me, or even any part of it?"
"I'll try," I offered.
Now that I wear skirts, my father has given me my mother's things. She had been dress help to a lady up at the keep when she was a girl and had letters taught her. I have some tablets she wrote. I'd like to know what they say."
"I'll try," I repeated.
"My father's in the shop."
She said no more than that, but something in the way her consciousness rang against mine was sufficient.
"I'm to get Scribe Fedrin 2 beeswax tapers," I reminded her. "I dare not go back to the keep without them."
"Be not too familiar with me,"
she cautioned me, and then opened the door. I followed her, but slowly, as if coincidence brought us to the door together. I need not have been so circumspect. Her father slept quite soundly in a chair beside the hearth. I was shocked at the change in him. His skinniness had become skeletal, the flesh on his face reminding me of an undercooked pastry over a lumpy fruit pie. Chade had taught me well. I looked to the man's fingernails and lips, and even from across the room I knew he could not live much longer. Perhaps he no longer beat Molly because he no longer had the strength.
Molly motioned me to be quiet.
She vanished behind the hangings that divided their room from their shop, leaving me to explore the store. It was a pleasant place. Not large, but the ceiling was higher than in most of the shops and dwellings in Buckkeep Town. I suspected it was Molly's diligence that kept it swept and tidy. The pleasant smells and soft light of her industry filled the room. Her wares hung in pairs by their joined wicks from long dowels on a rack. Fat, sensible candles for ship's use filled another shelf. She even had 3 glazed pottery lamps on display for those able to afford such things. In addition to candles, I found she had pots of honey, a natural byproduct of the beehives she tended behind the shop that furnished the wax for her finest products. Then Molly reappeared and motioned me to come join her. She brought a branch of tapers and a set of tablets to a table and set them out on it. Then she stood back and pressed her lips together as if wondering if what she did were wise. The tablets were done in old style. Simple slabs of wood had been cut with the grain of the tree and sanded smooth. The letters had been brushed on carefully and then sealed to the wood with a yellowing rosin layer. There were 5, excellently lettered. 4 were carefully precise accounts of herbal recipes for healing candles. As I read each one softly aloud to Molly, I could see her struggling to commit them to memory. At the 5th tablet, I hesitated. "This isn't a recipe," I told her.
"Well, what is it?"
she demanded in a whisper. I shrugged and began to read it to her. "On this day was born Molly Nosegay, sweet as any bunch of posies. For her birth labors, I burned 2 tapers of bayberry and 2 cup candles scented with 2 handfuls of the small violets that grow near Dowell's Mill, and 1 handful of red root chopped very fine. May she do likewise when her time comes to bear a child, and her labor will be as easy as mine, and the fruit of it as perfect. So I believe." That was all. And when I had read it, the silence grew and blossomed. Molly took that last tablet from my hands and held it in her 2 hands and stared at it, as if reading things in the letters that I had not seen. I shifted my feet, and the scuffing recalled to her that I was there. Silently, she gathered up all her tablets and disappeared with them once more. When she came back, she walked swiftly to the shelf and took down 2 tall beeswax tapers, and then to another shelf, whence she took 2 fat pink candles. "I only need..." "Shush! There's no charge for any of these. The sweet berry blossom ones will give you calm dreams. I very much enjoy them, and I think you will too." Her voice was friendly, but as she put them into my basket, I knew she was waiting for me to leave. Still, she walked to the door with me and opened it softly, lest it wake her father. "Goodbye, new boy," she said, and then gave me 1 real smile.
"Nosegay. I never knew she called me that. Nosebleed, they called me on the streets. I suppose the older ones who knew what name she had given me thought it was funny, and after a while they probably forgot it had ever been anything else. Well, I don't care. I have it now. A name from my mother."
"It suits you," I said, in a sudden burst of gallantry. And then, as she stared and the heat rose in my cheeks, I hurried away from the door. I was surprised to find that it was late afternoon, nearly evening. I raced through the rest of my errands, begging the last of them on my list, a weasel's skin, through the shutters of the merchant's window. Grudgingly, he opened his door to me, complaining that he liked to eat his supper hot. But I thanked him so profusely, he must have believed me a little daft. I was hurrying up the steepest part of the road back to the keep, when I heard the unexpected sounds of horses behind me. They were coming up from the dock section of town and being ridden hard. It was ridiculous. No one kept horses in town, for the roads were too steep and rocky to make them of much use. Also, the town was crowded into such a small area as to make riding a horse a vanity rather than a convenience. So these must be horses from the keep's stables. I stepped to one side of the road and waited, curious to see who would risk Burridge's wrath by riding horses at such speed on slick and uneven cobbles, in poor light. To my shock, they were regal in Verity, on the matched blacks that were Burridge's pride. Verity carried a plumed baton, such as messengers to the keep carried when the news they bore was of the utmost importance. At sight of me, standing quietly beside the road, they both pulled in their horses so violently
that Regals spun aside and nearly went down on his knees. "Burritch will have fits if you break that colt's knees," I cried out in dismay and ran toward him. Regal gave an inarticulate cry, and a half-instant later, Verity shakily laughed at him. "You thought he was a ghost, same as I. Whoa, lad, you gave us a turn, standing so quiet as that. And looking so much like him, eh, Regal?"
"Verity, you're a fool. Hold your tongue."
Regal gave his mount's mouth a vindictive jerk, and then tugged his jerkin smooth again. "What are you doing out on this road so late, bastard? Just what do you think you're up to, sneaking away from the keep and into town at this hour?" I was used to Regal's disdain for me. This sharp rebuke was something new, however. Usually, he did little more than avoid me, or hold himself away from me as if I were fresh manure. The surprise made me answer quickly. "I'm on my way back, not to, sir. I've been running errands for Fedrin." And I held up my basket as proof.
"Of course you have," he sneered. "Such a likely tale. It's a bit too much of a coincidence, bastard."
Again, he flung the word at me. I must have looked both hurt and confused, for Verity snorted in his bluff way and said,
"Don't mind him, boy. You gave us both a bit of a turn.
A river ship just came into town, flying the pennant for a special message. And when Regal and I rode down to get it, lo and behold, it's from Patience, to tell us chivalry's dead. Then, as we came up the road, what do we see but the very image of him as a boy, standing silent before us, and of course, we were in that frame of mind, and..."
"You're such an idiot, Verity!" Regal spat. "Trumpeted out for the whole town to hear before the king's even been told. And don't put ideas in the bastard's head that he looks like chivalry. From what I hear, he has ideas enough, and we can thank our dear father for that. Come on, we've got a message to deliver."
Regal jerked his mount's head up again, and then set spurs to him. I watched him go, and for an instant, I swear all I thought was that I should go by the stable when I got back to the keep, to check on the poor beast and see how badly his mouth was bruised. But for some reason I looked up at Verity and said, "My father's dead." He sat still on his horse, bigger and bulkier than Regal. He still always sat a horse better. I think it was the soldier in him. He looked at me in silence for a moment. Then he said, "Yes. My brother's dead." He granted me that, my uncle, that instant of kinship, and I think that ever after it changed how I saw the man. "Up behind me, boy, and I'll take you back to the keep," he offered. "No, thank you. Burritch would take my hide off for riding a horse double on this road." "That he would be, boy," Verity agreed kindly. Then, "I'm sorry you found out this way. I wasn't thinking. It does not seem it can be real." I caught a glimpse of his true grief, and then he leaned forward and spoke to his horse, and it sprang forward. In moments, I was alone on the road again. A fine misting rain began, and the last natural light died, and still, I stood there. I looked up at the keep, black against the stars, and here and there, a bit of light spilling out. For a moment, I thought of setting my basket down and running away, running off into the darkness and never coming back. Would anyone ever come looking for me? I wondered. But instead, I shifted my basket to my other arm and began my slow trudge back up the hill.